From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A new report by Human Rights Watch alleges the widespread sexual abuse of women inmates in U.S. state prisons by prison guards. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the findings with the principal author of the report, Dorothy Thomas, and with Deborah LaBelle, an attorney in Detroit who handles prisoner rights litigation. Also, we'll hear from a spokesman from the Michigan Department of Corrections, Warren Williams, who disputes the report's findings. And lyrics and lyricists. We talk with Maurice Levine about his popular series at New York's 92nd Street Y, and we'll sample some of the presentations from the past 26 years, which are now on CD, featuring lyricists discussing and performing their own songs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. For the second time this week, Wall Street is following the lead of overseas markets and is in sharp decline. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is off 119 points at 6,354. Analysts suggest investors' worries may have been partly triggered by a Wall Street Journal report suggesting foreign investors could slow down their purchasing of U.S. Treasury securities. That could help to increase U.S. interest rates. Stock markets in Paris, Frankfurt, and London lost a percentage point before the U.S. Wall Street market opened today. The government says prices at the wholesale level rose 0.4% in November, NPR's John Inste reports.
The producer price index was pushed up by the biggest jump in fuel costs since April, but a slight decline in food prices helped offset the overall increase. When the volatile food and energy sectors are excluded, the core rate of inflation, the one watched most closely by economists, rose just 0.1%. Analysts said that although energy prices climbed sharply last month, there are already signs that the price pressures in that sector are easing. Overall, they said the report showed inflation well controlled. So far this year, prices at the wholesale level have been rising at a 2.6% annual rate. Inflation at the consumer level has been somewhat higher. It's running at a 3.3% annual rate. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
Oil industry officials say now that Iraqi oil is on the world market, gas prices at the pump should start to fall. But they warn it will be a few months before this happens. Iraqi oil is officially flowing today for the first time in 6 years. Crude oil prices are starting to drop. They fell more than 3% yesterday after the United Nations officially lifted the Iraqi oil embargo. The United Nations Security Council is struggling behind closed doors to name a new Secretary General. France may be blocking the current front-runner. David Culhane reports from Paris.
They're calling it the language war. UN Undersecretary General Kofi Annan of Ghana has emerged as the leading candidate, but one of the permanent veto-bearing members of the Security Council voted against him. In these early straw ballots, no one has to reveal how they voted, and the French Foreign Ministry spokesman refused to say whether France cast the no vote. But Western diplomats believe it was France and that the reason is language. Annan speaks French, but he comes from English-speaking Ghana. What's more, he was educated in the United States. The other three candidates come from French-speaking African nations, and France has made no secret of its preference for that linguistic background. For National Public Radio, this is David Culhane in Paris.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has lost more than 119 points and is now at 6,354. Trading's heavy. The Nasdaq is down 12 points at 1,300. This is NPR. The FBI says a man has given them a photograph of somebody wearing a backpack in Atlanta's Olympic Park. The snapshot was taken about 6.5 hours before a bomb exploded there in July, killing 2 people and wounding scores more. The bomb was contained in a backpack similar to the one in the photograph. The FBI has set up a hotline for the public to call with tips. The agency says people have called to offer photographs and videotapes. The man who sent in this particular picture told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that the shot shows a white man with medium height and shoulder-length brown hair. A new study suggests anti-lock brakes, which are supposed to give drivers better control on slippery roads or in an emergency, aren't giving the safety benefits they were intended to. Dave Mattingly reports.
Anti-lock brakes are touted by the auto industry as a safety feature, one welcomed by insurance companies. But a study by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety shows occupants of cars with anti-lock brakes are more likely to be killed in crashes than those people riding in cars without them. The study also says single-vehicle crashes where a passenger is killed are 45% more likely to involve cars with anti-lock brakes. The fatality rate is also slightly higher in multi-car accidents. The reasons are unclear, but last year, the head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration warned that many drivers unaccustomed to the feel of anti-lock braking systems may mistakenly pump the brake pedal or oversteer, thinking the anti-lock brakes were not working properly. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
The Atlanta Olympic Committee reports it is closing the athletic game books with a surplus of nearly $10 million. Organizers are still collecting money. The International Olympic Committee gets half of any surplus. The U.S. Olympic Committee gets 25%, and the Atlantic Committee splits the rest with the city of Atlanta. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Being a woman prisoner in a U.S. state prison can be a terrifying experience, according to a new study just published by Human Rights Watch. The study documents the sexual abuse of women inmates by guards at 11 state prisons. The report is based on interviews with authorities in the federal government and state departments of corrections, district attorneys, correctional officers, civil and women's rights lawyers, prisoner aid organizations, and over 60 prisoners formerly or currently incarcerated in women's prisons. My guest Dorothy Thomas is a principal author of the report and head of the Women's Rights Project of Human Rights Watch. Joining us by phone is Deborah LaBelle, an attorney in Detroit who has represented prisoners in prisoner rights litigation for the past 10 years. Michigan is one of the states examined in the report. I asked Dorothy Thomas about the most common sexual crimes against women cited in the report.
Well, what's really shocking is that there's a whole range of abuses happening to women in state prisons across the United States, largely at the hands of male officers. You have everything from male officers actually raping and sexually assaulting female prisoners to them using pat frisks and other kinds of strip searches to abuse the women, whether by groping their breasts or their buttocks or their vaginal areas or otherwise inappropriately touching them. In addition, the male officers often watch the women when they shouldn't be during the times that women are in the toilets or they're dressing or undressing or they're in the showers. And in fact, we found that the prison environment generally is characterized by male officers crossing the line with the female prisoners, harassing them sexually, propositioning them, making explicit and often very lewd and degrading comments to the prisoners. The end result is that you have a correctional or custodial environment in women's prisons across the country that is really highly sexualized and ripe for the kinds of sexual misconduct that we found occur all too often.
Deborah LaBelle, you've been working with women who charge sexual harassment in prison for the past decade. Have you seen any obvious patterns or shifts in the types of charges that you're seeing or the way those charges are being addressed by the prisons?
Well, I think that that mostly I've seen it getting worse, that over the years there's been an increase in the usage of male guards guarding women prisoners. There's also been an increased isolation of prisoners in general, which impacts women prisoners. So the more isolated you get, the more difficult it is, the more easy I think it is to abuse people. And isolated meaning there's more restrictions on visitation, more restrictions on phones, less access to the media, more restrictions on letters. I mean, women are getting more and more isolated while they're having more and more men guard them with less privacy. So I think that there's much more difficult for them to reach out and make any kind of contact and be believed on these issues. And the population has increased. And as it increases, you've got more overcrowding. And so all of the elements that would make this worse situation, all the elements I think that would make the situation worse have been occurring. I would say in the last year or two, I think because of some involvement by Human Rights Watch, by the litigation that happened in Georgia, by some attention being brought by the Justice Department on these issues, that prison officials, especially in Michigan, are being forced to move off their stance of absolute and vehement denial. And while publicly they still may be denying that this happens, discrediting all reports, privately I think that they have been in the last 5-6 months taking some steps to try to address this internally.
Dorothy Thomas, the Human Rights Watch report on sexual abuse of women in prisons also notes that more men are guarding women in prison. Why is the proportion of men guarding women on the rise?
Actually, really what's happening is that the number of women in prison are on the rise. You've had a 400% increase of women being incarcerated in the United States over the last 10 years. More often than not, now they're going to be guarded by men. In our view, the real problem isn't that there are men in the women's prisons. The problem is that men are being put in these prisons without prison officials taking appropriate steps to make sure that they know what sexual misconduct is, that they're trained to refrain from such conduct, and that when officers cross the line and engage in inappropriate sexual abuse of female prisoners, they are in fact held to account. All too often now what happens is there's a kind of era of or aura of tolerance of this kind of abuse that happens within the custodial system, so that the male officers kind of believe they can get away with it, that nobody really will take the problem that seriously, and that they are unlikely to be disciplined for it accordingly. The women themselves, therefore, feel very reluctant to complain of the abuse. They don't believe that the prison officials will credit their claims, and they don't believe really that anything will be done about it. As a result, the issue is pretty much underreported and very much underdisciplined.
You've both pointed out that many women prisoners have been the victims of sexual abuse from family, neighbors, lovers before they got to prison. Do you think that affects their response to abuse in prison?
I think so. I mean, I think the statistics, I think people agree even nationally that over 80% of women, and a large percentage of men, but I don't know that that's been studied as much, over 80% of the women have been victims of sexual abuse by people in authority in their past. And so they come into prison with very shaky senses, both of their own self-worth, as well as a fear of reporting, a history of not being believed or being used in this way. And I think that that dramatically impacts their ability to withstand the kind of pressure for sex that comes when you're incarcerated.
Deborah LaBelle, you mentioned that there's a fear of reporting sexual harassment. Women are afraid that they will be punished if they report they've been harassed by a prison guard. When do women come to you and ask you to legally represent them?
Well, I hear from women long before they're willing to come forward and do anything about it often. Often I hear after it's happened, but with entreaties to keep it silent, that they're not ready, that they can't come forward because they have seen, and they'll name a particular woman who has come forward and what's happened to her. And what has happened to her has been a number of officers that I think are involved in this banding together to make life very difficult for that prisoner, from the range of being set up with drugs or being placed in getting excessive misconduct so that they're placed in segregation, again, isolated from their family so they can't see their children, and constant comments. I've been in the prison myself where I've come in and comments have been made to me when I've gone to see a woman who has come forward. Comments about what's going to be done to the prisoner when I leave. I can't be there all the time. What do I think I'm going to do? Protect her. And those, you know, so that they make that to an attorney on the outside who's free, it gives you some sort of reflection about what they're willing to say and do to prisoners on the inside. And when I say they, I obviously am not including all guards, but certainly there are a number of guards who have been involved and continue to be involved in these assaults. So to step back, I think, to your question, first I get the contact of women saying they're fearful to come forward. They can't say anything. They've been threatened if they say anything. And there is a long period of time, often ending with the women refusing ever to come forward, just trying to seek solace, maybe if I can get a counselor in to talk to them to try to keep some support system going for them, but who never come forward, never report it. There are other women who it just gets so too horrible. The sexual demands and the threats get so unbearable that in the end they see very little choice. When other guards start coming up and saying, "Oh, so you're giving it to so and so, another guard, how about me?" And it becomes to be clear that it's going to become a pattern, not just one guard with others. That's usually when women break with me, or they see a guard now starting to assault other women. And there is a fairly strong community within the women's prisons, and so while a woman may be willing to take it herself, if she sees a guard now starting on younger women who she feels responsible for, that's another thing that causes the breaking point in which women come forward.
Is it hard to corroborate a woman's story when she comes forward and accuses a guard of sexual harassment or rape?
Hard to corroborate for who?
Well, first of all, for you, because I'm sure you don't want to really take on a case unless you're pretty confident that there's some truth behind it.
That's true.
And also for Dorothy Thomas in the Human Rights Watch report on sexual abuse of women in American prisons. I mean, you want your report to be based on fact, not just hearsay or allegation. So for both of you, how do you corroborate that these women's stories are true?
I start with a premise, I admit, that you have very little to gain by reporting this and everything to lose. In reality, the punishments that come down, even when I represent women, have been severe. One woman in which I filed a suit, and in fact, they denied up to the point when the guard was finally convicted for raping another woman and settled before trial. She has spent the majority of the time since she filed the suit in segregation for various punishments, and she's become a pariah among the guards in prison. So there, what you gain is very little. So I do start with a basic credibility if a woman comes forward and tells me about it, and then you corroborate it in the usual ways. Do the times fit? Has there been... you know, is this guard have a history of this? Is she a credible person? Just like on the outside. I mean, here's someone who can say someone assaulted me and can tell you who did it and what they look like. If that happened on the outside, there'd be a warrant out. On the inside, it's, well, it's your word against his word.
One of the biggest difficulties in investigating sexual abuse of women in prison is that the systems are not in place within the prisons themselves to allow for such investigation. So prison officials often say, we have zero tolerance for this abuse, we investigate every single complaint. And yet when you really look into it, women prisoners often aren't believed when they come forward. They usually face retaliation when they do. Prison officials are as likely to protect their own as they are to investigate any complaint. And prisons themselves are notoriously reluctant to allow for any kind of independent oversight or investigation. So oftentimes, cases of sexual abuse that happen in custody can initially appear anecdotal, but it's partly because the system itself would like to keep it that way. In other words, it's better for prison officials for the issue to remain hidden behind prison walls than it is for them to be found culpable of allowing their officers to sexually abuse female prisoners. Most human rights abusers don't openly admit that they engage in the abuse. So our sense is that in order to really get a full-scale sense of what's going on in the prisons, it's going to require the prison systems themselves to be willing to look into this in more detail to make sure that when women come forward, they can complain without feeling they're going to be retaliated against, and to allow for some degree of independent investigation so that prison officials aren't simply left to investigate themselves, which is an obvious conflict of interest.
Dorothy Thomas is the principal author of the new Human Rights Watch report on the sexual abuse of women in U.S. state prisons. Deborah LaBelle is a prison rights lawyer in Michigan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Dorothy Thomas, a principal author of a new Human Rights Watch report alleging the widespread sexual harassment of women by prison guards in American state prisons. Joining us by phone is Deborah LaBelle, an attorney in Detroit who has handled prison rights litigation for the past 10 years. On the outside, one of the controversies often surrounding a rape case is whether it was consensual or not on the part of the victim. Is this often brought up inside, too? Are there charges that it wasn't really rape, it was consensual sex?
Prison officials will often introduce consent as a way to, in essence, blame the victim and escape responsibility for themselves or their own officers who are engaging in abuse. Based on the information that we were able to gather, it's really ludicrous to suggest that women in custody are submitting to the kinds of abuses that they're suffering willingly. These are custodial relationships. We're looking at officers who have virtually total authority over the women in almost every aspect of their lives. And even in those instances, and they exist, where the officers do not rape the women or sexually assault them, but in fact engage in sexual contact with them, I still have the question, where is it in their job description that they can have sex with the prisoners? I mean, in essence, when prison officials send the message that this is not a very serious abuse, they are both tolerating what is a gross breach of the officer's professional duty, and they are creating an environment in which much more serious kinds of sexual assault and rape can occur.
If a woman gets pregnant after being sexually abused by a guard, how is her pregnancy handled inside prison?
Well, in a prison environment where women prisoners' complaints of sexual abuse are often discredited by the officials, and where the officials themselves are very reluctant to find that their own officers are implicated in this kind of abuse, a pregnancy is actually evidence that such abuse is occurring and that something is very wrong within the correctional system. So that you find that women prisoners who become pregnant can often be subjected to particular kinds of treatment that often is actually punitive, so that, for example, in many of the cases we investigated where women became pregnant in prison, they are segregated away from the other prisoners. Now, allegedly, this is for their protection, and it does often result in them getting the appropriate health care. But it can also have a very punitive result. That is, they are segregated away from the population. They have less access to their attorneys and to other prisoners, as though they had committed a disciplinary offense, and yet they themselves are the ones who have been a victim of abuse. In addition, we find that because the evidence of sexual misconduct is so straightforward in cases where the woman is actually pregnant, there can often be pressure placed on her to undergo an abortion. That doesn't always occur, but in our experience, it does occur too often.
There are many women prison guards as well as male prison guards. Are there any problems with women abusing other women?
There have been, I am aware of instances of women complaining about inappropriate sexual behavior by women officers as well. I have not heard either the level of complaint regarding that that I've heard on male officers, nor, I have to say, has the department been as reticent to discipline those female officers as I've observed them being in disciplining male officers.
Dorothy Thomas, what are some of the recommendations Human Rights Watch is making about the sexual abuse of women in prison, how to prevent that?
The first thing that needs to happen is for officials at both the state and the federal level simply to acknowledge that this problem occurs. Too often, they will deny it or they will say they have zero tolerance for it, when in fact it's very widespread and they simply aren't doing enough to end it. So step one is to acknowledge the problem and take it from outside the prison walls. In addition, it's absolutely urgent that state officials put in place the proper prison rules and criminal law to ensure that when officers cross the line and they have sexual contact with prisoners, they will face appropriate disciplinary actions. And finally, probably most importantly, the Department of Justice really needs to pay much more attention to this problem than it actually is at present. That's not to say it doesn't care about sexual abuse of women in prison or that, in fact, it hasn't litigated a few such cases. But by and large, the problem is much bigger than the Department of Justice is willing to acknowledge. And when they take action, unfortunately, it's often much too little and way too late. So it's our view that if women in prison are to believe that they have people that they can go to other than the officials that are abusing them, they very much need the assistance and outlet to the Department of Justice, and that needs to occur as of today.
Where does the ultimate responsibility lie here, on the state level or the federal level?
Ultimately, the responsibility lies with three parties. The first is prison officials themselves. They have to make sure that guards in their employ are not having sex with prisoners within their care. Second of all, the state officials themselves have to make sure that they know what's going on in the prisons and that they aren't allowing inappropriate sexual misconduct to occur without doing anything about it. And finally, the ultimate responsibility really lies with the Attorney General of the United States. It's on that person's watch that sexual abuse of women is happening in U.S. prisons in states across this country. And that Attorney General has absolute responsibility to make sure that where such abuses occur, state officials are taking the appropriate action to sanction abusive officers, and that if they do not do so, they will be held to account by the highest authority in the land.
One last question. Do you find that there's a general lack of interest about abuse of women in prison? Because, heck, they're prisoners, they did something wrong, so if they're abused, it doesn't matter as much.
Deborah, would you like to answer that question?
I mean, I don't find that, but I may travel in certain circles that recognize that these are members of our community. They're serving, they broke the law, but they're mothers, daughters, children who are going to come back out, and that their sentence did not include being raped and abused in prison. They're serving time for breaking the law, but this is not part of what you're supposed to endure in that restriction of freedom. And I also think that the people I talk to find it quite appalling that officers and civil servants of the state of Michigan are using their power and their services to either force or have sex with prisoners.
In some cases, it's very like the situation with the Army. When people in the United States didn't know that Army officers were abusing their subordinates, nobody really cared about the problem. This is the same thing with what's going on in women's prisons. Unfortunately, it's a very hidden problem. Once it comes out and people know about it, I think any American should be concerned when a correctional official is abusing his authority to secure sex and other kinds of inappropriate contact with female prisoners.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
It's our pleasure.
Dorothy Thomas is the principal author of the new Human Rights Watch report on the sexual abuse of women in U.S. state prisons. Deborah LaBelle is a prisoner's rights lawyer in Michigan. We'll hear from a spokesperson from the Michigan Department of Corrections in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, publishers of The Christmas Mystery, a holiday tale by Yostein Garter, author of Sophie's World. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Alan J. Lerner, Yip Harburg, Johnny Mercer, Stephen Sondheim are just some of the people who have discussed and performed their work at the Lyrics and Lyricists series at New York's 92nd Street Y. Coming up, we'll hear some of those presentations and talk with the series' founder. And we continue our discussion about the Human Rights Watch report on the sexual abuse of women prisoners in the U.S. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the first half of our show, we heard about a new report by Human Rights Watch alleging the widespread sexual abuse of women prisoners by prison guards in U.S. state prisons. One of the states the report investigates is Michigan. The report charges that there have been serious sexual harassment problems in Michigan state prisons and that those problems have been tolerated at the institutional and departmental levels. Those findings are disputed by the Michigan Department of Corrections. Joining us is their chief spokesperson, Warren Williams.
We found that this report was full of a lot of unsubstantiated claims, a lot of cases, or some of the cases that were accurate were cases that had been resolved, disciplinary action had been taken against the guilty staff years ago. And generally speaking, you know, we'd like to reject in the strongest possible terms the assertion by Human Rights Watch that the sexual abuse, assault of women prisoners is a continuing and serious problem within our facilities here in Michigan.
I'm wondering what your records show about the extent of sexual harassment by guards of women prisoners. How often have you had to discipline or fire guards who have harassed women?
I don't have those figures right at my fingertips, but what I do have at my fingertips is during 1994 and 1995, female prisoners here in Michigan filed a total of 39 complaints alleging sexual harassment or sexual misconduct by staff. All of those were investigated, including 27 of those cases, which were referred on to the Michigan State Police, again, to ensure the most complete and unbiased review possible. And now, to date, 29 of those complaints, 29 of those 39, were not sustained, were not found valid following investigations. Six of those complaints resulted in disciplinary action against staff, and two of those complaints were referred on to local authorities for possible criminal prosecution.
If a woman prisoner is alone in a room where a male guard is abusing her, how does she substantiate her claims? Or does it just come down to a case of he said, she said?
Well, frankly, sometimes it is a case of he said, she said. All claims by prisoners misconduct, mistreatment by staff are fully investigated. And most are also referred then to the Michigan State Police for what we might consider to be a more unbiased, if you will, or at least to give the appearance of a more unbiased review. We have to take all of these claims seriously, even though many of them are proven to be not valid. And the problem is, you know, again, who do you believe? Now, we're dealing with a population of convicted felons, and, you know, believe it or not, female prisoners, female incarcerated individuals, will sometimes stretch the truth. You know, not all of them are paragons of truth and virtue. That's not to say that automatically everything they says is not true. But, you know, as a department with staff who we have to assume, and certainly we train to be professional and to be respectful of women, you know, people are innocent until proven guilty. We try as best we can.
Is there a code of conduct for guards that regulates what an appropriate pat-down is, or what is appropriate surveillance of showers and bathrooms?
We have policies, we have training modules that clearly show how pat-down searches, for instance, are supposed to be conducted. Let me mention that Michigan was the first state in the nation to develop mandatory training for staff specifically on how to deal with the special and unique needs of female offenders. And that's something we're really very proud of, and a lot of other states are now trying to emulate this training that we have on dealing with female offenders. Concerning showers, concerning surveillance of prisoners, you know, let's not forget, please, let's keep in the context that we're talking about correctional facilities. These aren't boarding schools for wayward women. So safety and the security of those institutions must be paramount. And the Supreme Court has held that incarcerated individuals do not have a right to privacy. There are security concerns that supersede an incarcerated individual's perceived privacy rights.
Have you found that there's a pattern that women who report sexual abuse by guards are punished for reporting it?
No, I have no evidence that that's the case. And, you know, I would certainly like for anybody to bring us forth specific examples, information, instances where that, in fact, was the case.
I think the implication of what you're saying is that a lot of women fabricate charges of sexual harassment and rape.
You know, what I'm suggesting is that certainly is not outside the realm of possibility.
Yeah, so I guess I wonder what the motivation...
I'm sorry. Well,
I'm wondering what the motivation would be for fabricating such charges.
Well, for instance, intimidation of staff. You know, their prisoners have their own agendas that they're trying to advance. Maybe they're looking for special favors or privileges. They understand that every allegation, every complaint is fully investigated, and that, in fact, can be, to the staff that's accused, hurtful and harmful. You know, regardless if that person is eventually exonerated. And again, every complaint is investigated, is looked into, and again, that puts that staff person under a cloud of doubt, if you will, of suspicion, at least until the investigation is completed. And frankly, sometimes that's wrong to the staff person.
I'm wondering if you think there are any inherent problems or tensions when men are guarding women in a prison in a situation where women will sometimes be naked because they're bathing or using the bathroom or undressing. I mean, this is the kind of exposure that usually only spouses or spousal equivalents and doctors have. I mean, it's a very uncommon situation. And you could say that sexual attention is inevitable in a situation like that.
Well, you know, there would be a number of people that would assert that there are tensions in male-female relationships regardless of the stage of dress or undress that one might be found in. You know, there are a couple of points, if you can, I'd like to try to make. You know, first, that Michigan's three correctional facilities for females are all headed by women. All of them we consider to be top-notch professionals, long distinguished service with the Department of Corrections. And more importantly, we think that they're good, compassionate people who would never, ever allow the kind of environment which the Human Rights Watch claims exists at their facilities. We consider that, and they consider that, to be personally offensive and repugnant. You know, about half of the staff working in Michigan's female facilities are women. Most of the male staff are good, decent citizens who, at least we presume, respect women. We demand that they will do so on the job, and to infer that many or most of these folks are engaged in direct or indirect complicity with raping and assaulting female prisoners is just flat out wrong. You know, it's wrong. It's a discredit to all of the good people that we have working in our correctional facilities here in the state of Michigan. You know, the fact that a very few staff may be sexist, abusive individuals is sadly reflective of the world outside of prisons. And again, those people that are found to be guilty of mistreating prisoners in any way, shape, form, or fashion are dealt with.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Yes, ma'am. You're very welcome.
Warren Williams is chief spokesperson for the Michigan Department of Corrections. Coming up, lyrics and lyricists. This is Fresh Air. There's a special pleasure in hearing songwriters sing their own songs. And that's one of the reasons the Lyrics and Lyricists series at Manhattan's 92nd Street Y has been a hot ticket for over a quarter of a century. The very first guest in 1970 was Yip Harburg, who returned several times. Here he is at the Y singing one of the beloved songs he wrote for The Wizard of Oz.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow.
Maurice Levine has been directing the Lyrics and Lyricists series since its inception. Saturday, he begins the 27th season. Many of the great lyricists who once appeared are no longer with us. That's why Levine now often presents scripted shows saluting lyricists. He told me that when he was invited to launch the series, he was working as a conductor on Broadway. He couldn't think of an interesting angle for the series until he spoke with Yip Harburg. Harburg shared some great songwriting stories, and Levine thought that's exactly what he should present on stage.
He gave me an example of one particular song of his, which really sticks in my mind. And that was Brother Can Spare a Dime. And he said, suppose I had written, my wife is sick, she just broke her leg, we're waiting for the doctor to come, brother, can you spare a dime? My kid's not doing so well, he's got diabetes, and they think he has a heart problem, brother, can you spare a dime? And go on and tell all the terrible things that were happening to people he knew, members of his family. He said, how long do you think people would listen to that? And I said, not very long, because it's just a recital of some terrible, terrible things. So he said, what I did write about was a man who was devoted to his country, who did all that was asked of him, and when he had done it all, his hands were empty. And he is confused. And, you know, once he built a railroad, made a run, made a race against time, and he finished it, and you got nothing for it. So you get this sense of a very sympathetic character and one who feels that he hasn't gotten a very good deal, as it were, from his own country. So he's confused. Brother Can Spare a Dime is the song of a confused, dedicated American. And that's a lyric.
So you presented Yip Harburg as the first person in the Lyrics and Lyricists series.
Yeah.
How did it go over?
It was a smash. And, I must say that when we had the whole idea of doing Lyrics and Lyricists at all, we thought, who could come to this kind of program? And we were thinking of 125 folding chairs in the art gallery would be about enough. And then in the last moment, we said, oh, what the heck, let's go for the big auditorium, which seats over 900. And it was our first program, and we didn't do badly at all. We had over 600 people, which was a pretty good turnout for our first event. What we didn't count on, or had no way of knowing, was that the press went crazy about the program. And about 2 days later, there were lines around the corner for the box office. And we were smack sold out, and we've been sold out ever since.
Well, I love to hear the stories behind the songs, so I thought I'd play Alan J. Lerner, the lyricist, talking at your Lyrics and Lyricists series about writing the lyric for the song On the Street Where You Live for the show My Fair Lady. And Frederick Lowe was his songwriting partner, of course, on this show. So here's the story behind On the Street Where You Live.
When we were writing Fair Lady, and we had this character, Freddie Einstein Hill, who was supposedly a threat to Higgins, and yet he didn't have much footage in the play. So it was decided that we'd better write a kind of a large song for him to try and make his presence felt. And we wrote this song this way. Well, Fritz hated it. From the very beginning, he hated it, and it made it very difficult for me to talk to him about it because I had lots of problems with the lyrics. I wrote the lyrics, first of all, incorrectly on purpose. The lyric should be, I have often walked down the street before, ba-da-da-da, my feet before, da-da-da-da-da, eat before. It should be that way. But it's a bore. Every time I spoke to him about it, he said, let's take it out. And I said, well, no, let's not take it out. I like the melody. So I couldn't talk to him about it. So I finally decided that I would interrhyme it in the middle, let enchantment pour out of every door, but I would try and find words so soft that maybe nobody would notice it. And so that's what happened. I have often walked down the street before, but the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before. All I want some eyes, Errol's eyes, high, knowing I'm, and so on. And it was literally done for oars and those kind of words, hoping that it would all slide by, and that would be that. When Columbia Records, who was making the album, and Mitch Miller at that time was the A&R man at Columbia, and he heard the song, and he loved the song, he said, but I hate that middle part. So Fritz, I don't care what you do with it, do anything you want with it. He hated it. So Mitch suggested that we take out the middle. Fritz was delighted. The less of it, the better. So it was taken out. I said, let's leave in the one part, because I did like the fact, the only thing I did like was, that it was, oh, the towering feeling, just to know, because those first long notes all rhyme, which nobody knew, but it was attractive vocally. So finally the play opened in New Haven, and the song was an absolute disaster. And the night after we opened, everybody met and said, let's take it out, change the singer, get a new song, the usual thing that goes on. But I still liked the song. And I couldn't understand why it was dying the way it was. Finally, one day, I began to wonder, after playing it about three or four nights and looking at it, I began to wonder if everybody was in Ascot Grays, and I was wondering whether anybody remembered him from the scene previous, you know? And I thought, well, perhaps if we change the verse and put the verse more in the style of what just happened, that maybe there'll be some shock of recognition. And to fortify that, I'll have somebody open the door and say who he is. So I said to Moss, can we try that? So Moss said, well, yes, you could try that if you wanted to. And so help me, the next night it stopped the show. And Moss came around to see me afterwards and he said, how dare you give me an inferiority complex? So this is the way the song then finally appeared in the show when it came to New York.
When she mentioned how her aunt bit off the spoon, she completely done me in, and my heart went on a journey to the moon. When she told about her father and the gin, and I never saw a more enchanting farce than the moment when she shouted, move your bloomin'!
Yes, sir.
Is Miss Doolittle at home?
Whom shall I say is calling?
Freddie Einsford Hill.
Oh, yes, sir.
And if she doesn't remember me, tell... tell her I'm the fella who was sniggering at her.
Yes, sir.
And you needn't rush. I want a drink in this street where she lives.
Yes, sir.
I have often walked down the street, but the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before. All at once am I several stories high, knowing I'm on the street where you any second you may suddenly appear. People stop and stare, they don't bother me, for there's nowhere else on earth that I would rather be. Let the time go by, I won't care if I can be here on the street.
That's Alan J. Lerner from his 1971 appearance at the Lyrics and Lyricists series at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. And that's one of the programs that's just been re-released on CD. My guest, Maurice Levine, has produced and hosted the Lyrics and Lyricists series since its start in 1970. By the way, the singer we heard was J.T. Cromwell. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mm-hmm. Back with Maurice Levine, on Saturday he begins the 27th season of the Lyrics and Lyricists series at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. Occasionally you had the pleasure of presenting a lyricist who presented the world premiere of a song, and I'd like to play an example of that now from your Lyrics and Lyricists series. And this is lyricist Fred Ebb with composer John Kander, and they were actually giving the world premiere of a song from the musical Chicago. And Chicago is now revived on Broadway, and it's, I guess it's about the hottest ticket on Broadway now. It's a big hit. So this was recorded in 1973. Do you have vivid memories of this recording?
Indeed I do. That was a very exciting night. By the way, those two gentlemen, when they got on stage, they just, as they say, tear up the joint. They're very, very exciting performers. And we had heard them go through the material we knew, you know, Flora the Red Menace, and Cabaret, and so on. And then Fred said, folks, how would you like to hear a world premiere? And that's what then happened when they did two numbers from a then show in progress.
Well, let's hear the world premiere of a song from Chicago. This is lyricist Fred Ebb with composer John Kander at the piano.
We're working on a show at the moment. It's called Chicago. It's going to be directed by Bob Fosse, and it's going to star Gwen Verdon and Chita Rivera. It takes place in the jazz age, you know, in the late 20s. I don't want to tell you much about it, except this might interest you. They both play murderesses. And if you guys are up for a world premiere, we'd like to sing the opening number for you. This is what a cheetah gets to sing. And during the course of this number, am I also interested to know, Gwen gets to shoot a guy 3 times. Town and all that jazz, and gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down, and all that jazz. Start the car, I know a whoopee spot where the gin is cold but the piano's hot. It's just a noisy hall where there's a nightly brawl and all that jazz.
There was lyricist Fred Ebb with composer John Kander at the piano from a 1973 recording, now available on CD, from the Lyrics and Lyricists series at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. My guest, Maurice Levine, has been the producer and host of the series since it started in 1970. Do you have a favorite lyric, or can you tell us what one of your favorite lyrics is?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. Like asking a parent with 10 children, which is your favorite of the 10? Gosh, I thought Night and Day is one of the great lyrics.
And what do you like about it?
I'll tell you what I like about it. In my estimation, it is the most passionate love song ever written. Can I do just a line or two from Night and Day?
I was hoping you'd ask.
Night and day, under the hide of me, there's such a hungry yearning, burning inside of me. And my torment won't be through until you let me spend the rest of my life making love to you day and night, night and day. That's a pretty good lyric.
Maurice Levine, I know a while back you had a stroke. How long ago was that?
Funny you should mention that. And I'm going to answer your question in just a second, except to say that I remember it was on November 13th of the year. I'll tell you in just a moment. And each year, November 13th has arrived. I just remember that night when it all happened. This year, it never occurred to me. I went I was the end of January before I realized, and excuse me, the end of November before I realized I hadn't even noted it was November 13th. So I think that's a good sign. But in answer to your question, if I had remembered, that would be my 17th year since the stroke, which I had in 1979.
Did you think after the stroke that you wouldn't be able to get back to work and get back to the Lyricist series?
Well, yes. Naturally, that crossed my mind. Without making it sound like a Hearts and Flowers thing, I think every stroke victim must go through this. Because when you're hit, you're hit. And in my case, I was 90% paraplegic. I just could wiggle my toes and fingers and so on. And I thought to myself, what happens if I never get beyond this point? And this is the way it's going to be the rest of my life. And little by little, it came back with therapy and all the great medical help I got.
Maurice Levine, I wish you continued success with your Lyrics and Lyricists series, and congratulations on the start of another new season.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Maurice Levine begins the 27th season of Lyrics and Lyricists Saturday at New York's 92nd Street Y. Several of those programs featuring Johnny Mercer, Alan J. Lerner, Sammy Kahn, and others are now available on CD on DRG Records. The Yip Harburg performance we heard is featured on the new CD Yip Sings Harburg on Koch Records. Our senior producer today was Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross. Here's Johnny Mercer at the Y in 1977 singing the first lyric he wrote.
I'll try and tell you a little about these things as I go along. And this is the first song. Mine's a hopeless case, but there's one saving grace. Anyone would feel as I do. Out of breath and scared to death of you. Love was first divined, then explored and defined. Still the old sensation is new. Out of breath and scared to death of you.
It takes all. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language, publisher of book, audio, and CD-ROM foreign language instruction programs. This is NPR, National Public Radio.